Our subject today is how to unite history and philosophy. So this will be an example of the unity of knowledge, a further chewing of the principle that all is one, that everything is interconnected. We will be focusing on the relationship between philosophy and, broadly speaking, science, more specifically, history. In order to illuminate further the point that I made in general terms last time, namely that there are no subjects. Knowledge is one. There are subjects only in the same way that this table has attributes. Separable aspects, which are important to separate out for specialized study, but crucial to integrate back into the whole so that at the end, you don't have a bunch of floating attributes, but a thing, a table. And similarly, at the end, you don't have a bunch of disconnected compartments reading economics, history, science, and so on, but one whole, which is knowledge of reality as a whole. And today we're going to try to integrate into such a whole philosophy and history. I want to start by asking the logical relationship between these two subjects. Which comes first in the structural, hierarchical development of knowledge, philosophy or history? Now, if I asked you, I could make, on the face of it, a compelling case in either direction. Let's start with the case that philosophy comes first. And here, I think you know in essence what the case would be. I just would say hierarchically, philosophy makes all knowledge possible. How can we study any particular aspect of the universe, including the past, until we first grasp the idea that there is a stable, causal universe, a natural universe, in which laws obtain, in which things are what they are, as against the kind of miraculous, erratic, Heraclitian universe that the pre-Socratics believed in. So we have to have some kind of metaphysics before you could study any science, including the past. And by the same token, you would have to have some kind of method of knowledge in order to acquire knowledge. You'd have to know that you start with observation, not revelation, that you're trying to be objective in your conclusions and not just come to any subjective feeling that you want to, that you're using logic, that you have to conceptualize your information, be rational, etc. So it seems like at least the key elements of epistemology are a precondition of any systematic rational study in any field, including the past. And you could go through the other branches of philosophy basically in a similar way. Even ethics, you need pro-life values of some kind. Otherwise, there would be no pursuit of secular knowledge. You'd be more like the ancient Egyptians or the medievals, where they were concerned essentially with how to die and how to minimize the pleasures of this life and regarded the pursuit of secular knowledge as an aberration. And there would, by the same reason, without some kind of pro-life values, there would be no discovery of the material instrumentalities that it requires and the material uses to which it could be put. So you need some kind of pro-life values and even some degree of freedom and of the recognition of the value of freedom. Otherwise, in a total dictatorship, all thought would come to an end, and you would never pursue science. So from that point of view, I can make seemingly a very strong case that philosophy has to precede all knowledge, certainly including science and including history. Now, if you're Hegelian, let's call that the thesis. So that will immediately lead to the antithesis, because we now ask the question, where does all this knowledge of philosophy itself come from? It's not innate. We're not born with it. Now, obviously, certain axioms are self-evident. Many points are implicit. But certainly the whole of no philosophy, including objectivism, is either self-evident or implicit in your early perceptions. So where did Ayn Rand get it from? Where did she get objectivism from? And how did she validate it? Now, it's easy enough to say, well, she got it from reality, because we know that that's where you have to get knowledge if you don't get it from God or introspection. But specifically, what part of reality? Did she get it by studying the stars or the ebb and flow of the tides? And obviously her answer was, philosophy is essentially the study of what? Man. From a normative angle, we're leaving aside here metaphysics, which is really just the law of identity. But the rest of philosophy is a study of man, how man should know, how he should value, how he should form governments, how he should create art. And how can you study man, she held, except by studying men throughout history? Not just the men around you today. If we want to reach conclusions about men inductively, in other words, we want to generalize from our actual observations, as rather than getting these conclusions from some authority or some authoritative text, then you have to study the subject in question in all the varying conditions in which it exists and under all the varying circumstances across time. Nietzsche made a very excellent point as to why it was impossible to discover the nature of man by simply abstracting from the men around you. Because he asked, in essence, he had it much more eloquently, but I didn't bring it and look it up, but the substance of his question was, how do you know, when you perceive certain behavior, what is the nature of man and what is the mood of a period? Even if you see the behavior extremely widespread. Now, for instance, if you looked around today, and this is what more intelligent people do, they look around today and they come to horrendous conclusions about human nature on the basis of statistical generalities, which definitely go beyond chance, and there's a tremendously positive correlation. For instance, they look around in the day and it's very easy to say man is anti-intellectual. If you look at the Republican Party, you'd have to say he's either amoral or a religious nut. No matter where he is, in what country, even in America, he's essentially statist. Now, you can find people, objectivists and others, who are exceptions. But then the way most people would say is, you are lonely exceptions. I can't explain you, but you certainly don't represent human nature, judging by the mass trend of billions on the earth and a few little pockets here and there of somebody who's different. There is no way to answer this, except if you want to be able to look back through history and see on the scale in which today the overwhelming evidence is anti-intellectuality and statism, was there ever a period where the overwhelming evidence was pro-reason and pro-individualism, and where the opposite was just a tiny, lonely exception? That will give you crucial knowledge in regard to your view of human nature that you cannot get from just looking around you today. And of course, if you know about, just to mention a couple of examples, the Greek civilization, and something about it, you know right away, you cannot blame man's nature for what goes on today. And the same thing is true if you know about the Enlightenment civilization, United States in the 18th century. It would be impossible to say man by his nature depends upon government and wants nothing but to suck at the breast of an all-powerful welfare state. History is the great laboratory in the study of man. You get to see him under all conditions, under all states of knowledge and ignorance, under the influence of reason in some periods, under the influence of unreason or anti-reason in some periods. When he's free, when he's in a mixed economy, when he's completely enslaved, when he's rich, as in today's West, and when he's poor, as throughout most of history, when he's religious, when he's unreligious. It gives you man, human nature, in all the varying essential conditions. And therefore, it gives you the material of all abstractions about man. You cannot even know the full nature of rational being, assuming that you'd reach that definition, if you did not know, well, for instance, what does slavery do to him? If it turned out that he's a rational being, but under a Sparta in the ancient world, or under Soviet Russia in the modern, he still was able to think and invent and pursue science and so on. It's just that, you know, his life as a consumer was curtailed and interfered with by the state. That would make a radically different picture of the nature of a rational being than what actually happens, which is that all creativity comes to an end, the mind stops, and utter stagnation sets in. What does freedom do to him? If you didn't have United States and Athens in its best period as examples, you would have no idea what's the connection between a rational being and freedom, and therefore, to that extent, what is a rational being's nature? Can he combine religion and reason? Well, you can look at history. You can see Thomas Aquinas tried to do it. What happened? It's very interesting that by trying to do it a certain way, religion went on the defensive and it led to modern secularism, but did it really? Or did Aquinas know even more than we know now? And is the fact that the world is on its way back into what seems like a rise of fundamentalism evidence that you cannot compromise with religion except for a short period of time? And we look back at what the pagans did with the rise of Christianity when the pagans decided to compromise and they went totally religious. Now, I'm not going to resolve that question today. I'm simply saying to you, if you want to ask, can man combine reason and religion, it is insufficient to have a theoretical technical argument to the effect of, well, if reason, then non-religion, if non-religion, then etc. You have to look at the actual facts. So history tells you what is the enduring essence of man amid a variety of conditions, and how does it function under different premises and conditions, and thereby what laws govern it. These are the facts from which philosophy then says, well, look, the successful eras were built on and the failures came from the opposite, so and so. Without this kind of experimental data, only rationalistic deductions from the word rationality would be possible. And all philosophers do this. They all start by saying, or at least they used to in the days when they said anything, they all start by saying, yes, we should be rational. And then Plato would say, now, since motion is opposite to reason, rationality means squelching the emotional element. And since rationality means the conceptual faculty, that means studying the other world. And you end up, you know, with a view of reason that would curl your hair, but he got it all by deduction from his view of reason. And every single philosopher has their deductive argument. That is of no use. No use. Anybody can start with a definition and then deduce from it. The point is to get your definition from the condensed findings about the nature of man as he actually occurs in history. So if you want to find man's need, you have to see what happens when they're stifled or fulfilled. So we can say that philosophy is the widest abstractions, but we reach them only through the lesser concretes of the centuries. Some of you know the story that Ayn Rand in college majored in history. And that always baffled me. And I asked her one day, why did you care? Aren't you interested? I always thought you were interested in men as they ought to be, not men as they were. What is the connection? And she just looked at me with a smile and she said, how am I supposed to discover what they ought to be? I had never thought of the answer. I thought, you read the Fountainhead. That was... But her point was, a knowledge of the past is essential to reach a knowledge of what ought to be. So in this sense, history is a precondition of philosophy and not vice versa, as we first assumed. And that is what I want to chew today. That history is not just an illustration of previously known philosophic principles. It's actually the inductive source of those principles, and thus the ultimate validation of those principles. Now, I understand that this is going to bother a lot of people, so I'll say something to sort of take the sting of this away before I go into the concretizing of it, because we have a large contingent here who believes that philosophy is the queen of the sciences, precedes and validates everything, and that nothing can come before philosophy. So let's just answer briefly the paradox. How can philosophy be a precondition of history and vice versa? It's like the chicken and the egg. How is it possible? Philosophy must be there to make possible organized knowledge, and the organized knowledge must be there as a base from which to abstract philosophy. Now, this was a cliffhanger. I'd leave it until next week. Who has a clue to the answer? It lies in certain epistemological issues. Now, can you make it all the way there and give me a clue without losing the whole entire morning? He came in first, yes.
Does it have to do with the...
Louder.
Does it have to do with the spiral of knowledge?
It absolutely has to do with the spiral theory of knowledge. It has to do with the fact that knowledge is not a straight line. It's a spiral. So there really is no contradiction or paradox here. Certain essential parts of philosophy, certain axioms and corollaries, enough to get the mind started, have to be grasped at the outset in implicit form. Not yet explicit form, because we don't know enough to get it explicitly. But that implicit knowledge, combined with observation and reasoning, makes possible a certain development in specialized realms, like such as math, this is what actually happened historically, such as in arithmetic, in geometry, in astronomy, in physics, up to a point, at which point you have enough concrete information to spiral back to your starting point and identify some of those implicit points explicitly, which is really what Aristotle did to the pre-Socratics. They implied a certain view of the world. They went on and tried to flesh it out and give some detail. And then Aristotle, standing on their shoulders, looked back and made explicit a lot of the things that they took for granted and couldn't make explicit at their earlier stage. He was able to see in a fuller context and thereby to reach conclusions that they couldn't, developed certain sciences more thoroughly, and then that permitted him and his later followers to spiral back and expand and elaborate the earlier philosophy, formulate higher level principles within the philosophy, which in turn makes possible higher stages in the knowledge of science, etc. So the spiral theory is essential. You don't start, get all philosophy, and then move methodically to history. You move toward a subject, and then after a bit of that, you come back and get a fuller context. You make the implicit explicit. You suddenly see the connections. You're able to abstract more explicitly because it's not just something hidden. It's something now that runs through many different aspects. And then using that, you're able to break open new territory. And having done that, you have more information retroactively on the things that you first got, and you keep going like this. That's why Ayn Rand called knowledge a spiral. And so that in actual fact, there is no answer to which comes first, philosophy or the sciences, philosophy or history. Knowledge develops both ways at once. The only thing you can give philosophy the absolute priority over is that it implicitly has to give you the basic axioms to delimit reality and consciousness and identity, otherwise you couldn't function. But philosophy is a hell of a lot more than the basic axioms. Knowledge actually develops both ways at once. Philosophy makes science possible. In a sense, that's true. And if you abstract that one movement, just the movement from philosophy making possible the sciences, you get the first point that I made today. But by the same token, science, with all the concrete details, cases, and trends that we observe, makes it possible for us to formulate philosophy and validate it, and that is the other point. That would be the point that in our case, history makes philosophy and its validation possible. Now, instead of this bothering you, you should be able to integrate this to lecture one. If you have the view that there's a whole bunch of separate compartments, there's philosophy, there's economics, and there's history, and they're, you know, separate, watertight, you get through one and that enables you to get to the next, you are going to be very, very badly bothered and upset by this interpenetration and this real spiral back and forth. But if you really get the view that it's only one universe and there's only one subject matter, existence, and all our subdivisions and subjects are aspects abstracted from this one, then you will not be bothered by the fact that we use certain aspects to clarify others, and then those in turn make the first even clearer, and you keep going with one continuous total all the time. If you're a PhD candidate and you devote 12 years of graduate study to how many feathers was on the head of some duke in some 12th century painting, then of course this whole approach is inconceivable to you because the idea of looking at one whole painting is inconceivable to you. But you can't approach it that way. Philosophy, instead of being honorific, you have to think of it as a set of broad abstractions that have to be based on concretes. But those broad abstractions make methodological study possible, which in turn enables us to get the data to secure the very broad abstractions that we started with. So it's like a benevolent circle instead of a vicious circle. And it's only if you forget the fact that it's all as one, or as I have emblazoned up here, the true is the whole, that you get into seeming paradoxes. Now I want to start chewing our specific topic. You know perfectly well how philosophy depends, how everything depends on philosophy. I want to look at the other side now. How different aspects of philosophy depend on history, which does not contradict the reverse, not if you grasp the spiral approach, and that all is one. Let's start with the simplest branch of philosophy, politics. How do you learn or validate the objectivist politics? You can't say Atlas Shrugged. You can't even say Adam Smith, because he didn't write in a vacuum. How did Ayn Rand learn it? Well, let me tell you two ways that you can't learn it. One is rationalism and one is empiricism, for two wrong answers. The rationalist approach, filtered through objectivism, would be something like this. Well, man survives by the faculty of reason. Reason is the antithesis of force. Force is the monopoly of the government. Therefore, government is the enemy of reason and survival. Therefore, government must not use force against man, therefore the American system. That is as close as you can get to what we call rationalism. Just a parade of broad abstractions in a vacuum without concretes, with no connection to reality or context. And as I think you can see, there's a lot of you here that if I put you in a room and said, your life depends on validating objectivist politics, I would extort that from you. I would extract it from you, because that's all you would have to say. Well, let's say, hopefully not a lot of you, but some of you would feel, well, that's the best I can do. I've tied it to the nature of man and I've gone through a series of objectivist principles. But you should be able to see that that kind of validation of the objectivist politics or of capitalism is utterly artificial. There is no way to distinguish that from 100 other rationalist constructs, because there's no facts and no context to enable you to interpret the conclusion. Why not then take a libertarian conclusion from that same argument? If government is force and force is anti-mind, then get rid of government. Liberty is good. It shouldn't be interfered with. We should have anarchy or competing governments. You know, all this libertarian nonsense comes from their rationalism and complete detachment from reality. And they start with, you mustn't use force. Why not? That's the absolute. Why? Well, they got it from Ayn Rand, and that they could not understand on a deeper level than that. So they start with that and then just make any kind of deduction from that. You cannot arrive or add or validate philosophy by deduction. As Ayn Rand said, all crucial philosophic ideas come from induction, not deduction. From induction, not deduction. Now, of course, empiricists claim to rest on induction and on facts. And if they heard one of these deductions that I just gave, they would sneer. That's one of those crazy rationalists off in an ivory tower and so on. But what does the empiricist have to offer in its place? Typical empiricists today will say, well, just look around you at the way contemporary governments work. And you will see that certain things work and others don't. Congress isn't working right now. But Clinton is working, because they're all left. He's left. So then they start having debates among themselves. How do you know what things work? And even if certain things are conceded to work by observation, in the sense that there's no riots in the streets, the Gallup poll says 63% approval, why do some things work and some don't? And then they have their theories. And the theories are all equally profound. The Republicans think that things don't work because the wrong people are in office, and that the solution would be term limits. Then everything would work. All we have to do is keep the welfare state, Franklin Roosevelt, the whole bit, but just keep kicking them out of Congress so that an entrenched, lifetime tenured bureaucracy could make all the decisions. Or the moderates say, the system is great, It's just that some factions go to extreme. That's the trouble. They want to get rid of all welfare, get rid of all government regulation. And what we need is some moderation. Or the radicals say, well, look, it's a changing world. There's so much complexity now and overpopulation. You know that whole bit. So you can come up, if you have no philosophic framework, no guidance, and you just raw observe the world, you have no means whatever to decide what works, or what do you mean by work, and why does it work. So you get no lessons whatever, except of the superficial kind that you get in newspaper editorials. So neither rationalism nor empiricism is a way to validate politics. Now, Ayn Rand always acknowledged the founding fathers as indispensable to the objectivist politics. In essence, their politics, although not their ethics, but their politics is the same as ours. Now, she didn't just take it on faith from the founding fathers. She had to retrace firsthand in her own mind all of the contributory data that they had to process. She had to, in effect, duplicate the founding fathers' cognitive process in order to end up with a validation of the American system. Now, what was it in essence? I can't take you through every step that the founding fathers had to do. They were revolutionaries. They did not copy any pre-existing system. Nor, however, did they just sit there one day in Philadelphia and say, I got a great idea. Let's start off this way. They were very learned men. They turned to history. They all knew history extremely well. They spread out before them a vast array of past attempts to organize society. All of those attempts represented possibilities, potential models on which to build a new country. And they could see by observing these models and the actual historical consequences what were the characteristic results for good or evil of the various kinds of systems. This was utterly indispensable knowledge without which they could not have functioned. Now, some of this they got by way of their own astute observations. A great deal they got from whom? Well, that they got ideas from Locke, but from whom did they get the knowledge of how the various systems worked, what consequences came from monarchy and oligarchy and democracy and etc.? Aristotle and Plato. They knew Plato and Aristotle, as educated men did in those days, and Plato and Aristotle were both historians of politics. Both of them tried to classify all the main kinds of states that had existed even back then, and then to show these are the only alternatives, and these are the results of the different alternatives, and this is my explanation, and therefore this type is the best state. And they are full of arguments, usually very excellent, enduring arguments against the systems they dislike, and not that convincing arguments in favor of the one they liked. Plato, you know, was for the philosopher king, and Aristotle was for something called polity, which is a kind of a cross between private property and majority rule. Not too clear. They did not yet, Plato and Aristotle, have the concept of rights, which was not originated at the time, to enable them to reach the right conclusion. But they made the start. The definition, systematization, description of the main possibilities. And usually their criterion of classification was what? Which is the logical place to start if you don't know anything else, if you don't know rights. Who should have power? Who should rule? A state has the power to enforce its decrees. And so they classified all the different groups according to monarchy, one man, aristocracy, the best, oligarchy, a few, with the implication that they're a nebulous, nefarious few, democracy, unlimited majority rule, the mob, etc. They were all something crassy, rule by. And in those classifications, we have a historic step, the first step toward reaching centuries later a valid politics. It was improved on and elaborated by later thinkers, but the founding fathers knew all this. They knew the standard Greek and Latin sources for an educated 18th century man. They saw the flaws of all the standard types, most often, as I say, flaws pointed out by Plato and Aristotle themselves, and they could see then, since they knew the world post-ancient, all of this ancient knowledge enriched by the later knowledge. For instance, medieval tyranny, they could classify very easily with Egyptian theocracy. And so they saw there's a real principle here. If you bring religion in to the state, you're dead. And that is on observation across thousands of years in different cultures. They saw modern monarchy, the divine right of kings, and they had no trouble seeing how that related to ancient tyranny. They had no penchant for democracy. They knew what happened in Greece with mob rule. And so they reached this position. They wanted a system in which there was no elite. The people had the power. We're still under the premise, somebody's got to have the power. Sovereignty has to reside somewhere. The people have to have the power, but not a democracy. And this they reached through a combination of logic and history, helped along by Aristotle's observation that it has to be the kind of society where people act by rule of law. Now, actually, what the founding fathers wanted, we're slowing down their historical problem, is something that seemed to be an utter paradox. They wanted a system in which the individual was sovereign while the people held power. You have to think of it from the point of view of somebody discovering this. They were strongly individualistic. They were certainly not collectivist or tribalist, but there was no American Constitution yet and no Declaration of Independence to explain this. So they wanted this system. If you ask them at this birth moment, before the birth of the intellectual conclusion, they wanted a system in which the individual ruled, and yet, of course, the people ruled, because it had to be majority rule, and yet no one ruled. Now, that is a real conundrum. That is a real problem if you don't have the American Constitution and 2 centuries of how it worked behind you. It sounds like an impossibility. Now, the key to their revolutionary idea was, of course, which is so easy for us to say now, but the whole point is to try to put yourself in the context where it wasn't easy and grasp what a revolution it was. They grasped the idea of the people rule, but with absolute limits defining the sovereignty of the individual. Now, they got the direct theory of that from Locke, the idea of individual rights. But rights as a concept also had a history, and Locke could never have grasped it or formulated it on his own. You can be certain of that. Rights goes back as a concept to the ancient Stoics, to Cicero, among others, to the later Roman Empire. And as I understand, it was not primarily a principle of government at all when it was first founded. On the contrary, it was a principle of one's allegiance to something more important than government. It was your defense against the government. It was your right relation to God as against the state. So it was kind of a religious area of separation that nobody could violate. Now, the uniqueness of the Founding Fathers' experiment was to construct a constitution, taking the best of the historical states and building a secularized concept of rights into the actual fabric of the state. They took the sovereignty of the people as a whole, as against elitism. and dropped the idea that that meant the people rule the individual, because democracy was out. And they made its basis a government based on rights through the concept of you delegate your power to the government, but only the power you have. So you see, their revolution consisted of grasping historical facts, combined with the need of a sovereignty of the individual that the state can't touch, and then making that the very basis of the government. And so you had the uniquely American idea that government is the servant, not the rulers. Now this upset all traditional notions and classifications. This is a total revolution. But it required, my point is, the earlier knowledge. It required the observation of the results of the earlier attempts, and then the more sophisticated knowledge as of rights, and then the bold experiment. The Founding Fathers nowhere deduced rights from the nature of man, because I tried to find it. For one of my books, I tried to find this deduction. You know, I wanted a syllogism, I wanted Jefferson or somebody to say something like, if thought is not free, then there is no thought. If there is no thought, then man cannot survive. Therefore, if there is no free thought, man cannot survive. But if there is no right, then there is no free thought. I wanted it all in the form of a rationalistic deductive syllogism, which I was, you know, with many more steps in between. It was going to be absolutely airtight, and it just isn't there. And for all I know, if you told that to Jefferson, he would very legitimately say, I never thought of that. They did not have deductive certainty going into their revolution. They had a whole series of observations of good and bad from past governments. They had a basic revolutionary idea that they injected into it, and then they had the boldness to try the untried. Now, looking back a century or two later, a genius can say, it was a smashing success. I see in detail that it worked, and now I'm able to see what? Why it has to work. In other words, after a century or two of this system being in existence and seeing how it works in detail, the data are there for a mind like Ayn Rand to observe, integrate, explain, and connect it to morality and epistemology and fundamentally validate it. But if you said to me, suppose the Founding Fathers did not precede Ayn Rand, suppose there was no capitalism tried, we had only, what the is that system, not feudalism, but the mercantilism, what would her politics have been? Would she have known how to implement egoism in politics? How long would it have taken her? Would she have reached the American Constitution? Would she have reached the total separation of state and economics? I maintain that, and I'm sure she would have maintained, that these questions are unanswerable. She would have had to traverse what the Founding Fathers traversed. And it's a question of how many revolutions you can do in one lifetime. You know, you just don't have the time or the mental space to start off with Thales and do everything from Thales, you know, on to the 20th century. The point is that she built on historical fact, including the Founding Fathers, and they did too and had to. So then which comes first? Americanism as philosophically valid or as historical fact? Which? Well, you can look at it either way because it's a benevolent circle. Once you know the historical facts, you can give a preliminary validation of the United States approach. And then you can use that to judge and evaluate all the historical examples, but you needed those examples to get to Americanism. So it's again, it's exactly the kind of spiral which is what all of knowledge has to be. Now, I maintain that every crucial issue in philosophy is like that. And that if you scorn history, You are simply cutting yourself off. If you just read Galt's speech or Rourke's speech or my book, are just like condensed synopses of the conclusions that people got by working in the field, by actually digging into what happened historically. And I depended very heavily on Ayn Rand because my own knowledge of history is fairly shaky. I have certain periods that I got to know through studying philosophy, and other periods that blissfully go by certain centuries. But I always find history of interest, and every once in a while I get the desire to make history a central focus and start to teach just, you know, from Adam to Clinton, and, you know, just cover the waterfront. Now, I want to just indicate to you in pattern how some of the other, even more abstract branches of philosophy depend upon history. And let's start with metaphysics and epistemology. Now, here by history, I don't mean past failed endeavors, but past achievements in cognition, which become the concretes necessary in order to induce and abstract the proper methodology. Let's take as one example the relationship of logic as an art, the organon, logic as a science, and mathematics. Which comes first? Does logic make mathematics possible, or vice versa? Does mathematics make logic possible? Now, in an obvious sense, logic comes first. You can always make the case that philosophy precedes everything else, because you have to use logic, you have to grasp its laws and methods implicitly in order to think at all, in order to deduce in any field, including mathematics. Obviously, the implicit grasp of A as A precedes any subject, including mathematics. But now let's ask, how did Aristotle come to grasp logic as an explicit subject matter, an explicit method? What he called the organon, the instrument, the tool of thought. Now, he grasped in the organon not just a given logical argument, not just the structure of some one logical argument, which would have been not enough to abstract from, but the whole systematized theory of logic. Logic is an abstract canon or set of rules to govern all human thought. Now, he did not get this out of a vacuum, nor by walking around and listening to people chat on the street and saying this is A, B, B, C, C, D, and oh, this one is M distributed middle and this one is so and so. Obviously, you couldn't do just collect structures without context. You would have nothing would serve as a grand scale, rich enough example of a logical structure for you to be able to abstract away the content. He needed a major organized exhibition of pure logic and detailed application from which he could then abstract away the concrete subject matter and get the general idea of systematic logical connection and the various rules that govern it. And did he find that in any of the natural sciences? Not at that time. They were too undeveloped. They were too much mere accumulations of empirical data. There was only one subject that had a developed formal logical structure was mathematics. And specifically, what you'd have to call pre-Euclidean geometry. Pre, because there was a lot of geometry organized before Euclid. And Aristotle, to my knowledge, had finished the organon before Euclid finished systematizing the earlier geometrical knowledge. But this pre-Euclidean geometry was crucial to Aristotle's ability to formulate logic. And again, you see the pattern. There was an implicit philosophy, an implicit grasp of identity, and then lots of observations and discoveries within the field of math, including which far antedated Aristotle, the Pythagorean theorem, you know, the squares on the two sides is equal to the square of the hypotenuse, etc. And this led to a specialized study of geometry. And that made possible Aristotle's ability to abstract away from the specific content and focus only on the structure. And that led to an explicit, formalized, logical laws, which then opened the door to go on to higher branches of mathematics, which opened the door for the Renaissance to integrate mathematics and physics, etc. It's always the same pattern. In a sense, logic precedes deduction, but large-scale deduction had to precede logic. And again, the solution is the fact that all knowledge is one. That's just two movements within one single ongoing unity. And I believe we're going to take a 5-minute precise break at this point. I want to do one more example of the dependence of philosophy on science, this time from metaphysics, and then I'm going to go to ethics. So let's ask this question. Which comes first, causality or physics? Physics gives us a knowledge of natural regularities and natural law. Again, you can make the obvious point that cause and effect have to come first if you believed in a miraculous universe or things happen by chance. There would be no attempt to formulate a law. You have to believe in order to find it. On the other hand, why believe in it? Is it a deduction from the law of identity? Did somebody sit back and say, since A is A, entities must act in accordance with their natures, and therefore the same cause will lead to the same effect? Again, that would be impossibly rationalistic as a method of discovery. That is fine as a method of summary of something that you have learned inductively. And the actual pattern of learning causality was long and complex. Thales implicitly believed in an orderly universe. He threw away supernaturalism by simply asking the question, what is everything made of? Thereby getting rid of the whole idea of some supernatural interference. Then men observed specific instances of order, specific regularities. They started seeing cause and effect in the remotest areas, in the heavens, in biology. And of course, this wasn't only Greeks. They drew on the knowledge of earlier civilizations to an extent. They accumulated a lot of instances of cause and effect. Did this then let them go right away to a generalization? Every event has a cause? No, it did not. None of the Greeks, except possibly Democritus, who was considered tangential and a freak because he was an atomist, which at that time was just considered a far-out rationalist theory. None of the Greeks had a real concept of causality, including Aristotle. He believed that the rule of causality was something happens always or for the most part. In other words, there are exceptions to every causal rule, but it counts as a law if it happens either always or for the most part. He thought there was an element of accident. So he really did not have, although he gave the materials to get, he did not have a real scientific or objectivist concept of causality in terms of the inexorable action of an entity with identity, although about 23 centuries later, some of his followers worked out that argument on the basis of what he said after they had abundant evidence of the development of science. But he himself couldn't yet find these precise connections or correlations between cause and effect. he nevertheless did say enough to keep men looking. It was really not until the Renaissance, when they introduced the experimental method and mathematical physics, that people began to find laws on so abundant a scale that cause and effect became an obvious principle of reality. It was considered an axiom in the 18th century, which it isn't either. It's a corollary of an axiom. But in this sense, the history of physics precedes the complete validation of a major metaphysical issue and validates it. While in the other sense, the reverse was true. The implicit belief in order was required to get enough regularities so that you could then build up enough science so that you could then work out the validation of order. So it's these things are more complex, and it's actually very interesting to study the history of certain key philosophic ideas and see what was required and what stages they went through to get validated. They were never validated, by rationalistic deduction, the way objectivists sometimes today do. And if you thought of yourself as explorers in philosophy on the sea of history, reaching for data wherever you can find and trying to induce your conclusions. Someday I'm going to give a course called Objectivism Reached Inductively, in which there's going to be no reference to any books of mine or anybody else's, and no reference to any arguments of why this follows inevitably from that, from that, from that. It's going to be only starting with observations and inducing general principles, and then in no order. And then next week saying, is there any connection, any integration between these two? And then actually enacting the spiral and saying, now does this second one give us any light on the first in the actual way that knowledge would acquire and would arise, and that after every 30 or 50 weeks of that, at that point, you could say, now we can organize it all into one system and read Opar or Galt's speech or whatever. And then you would really have it, as opposed to the empty rationalistic method. All right, let's turn to ethics. As our last type of example. Reason is man's basic means of survival. It's really the essence of the objectivist ethics. That's the key to both Rorke's speech and Galt's. That's why all the virtues are forms of rationality, why the top value is reason. All the different aspects are reason applied to moral judgment and so on. Now, do we learn that reason is man's basic means of survival by studying the nature of man or the history of men? Now, I had one OGC class in which that was hotly contested. And everybody said, no, you have to learn by the nature of man. But how do you discover the nature of man? You have to observe the acts of men across vast stretches of time and then abstract the essentials. In other words, by induction, not by deduction. Ayn Rand used to say that all crucial philosophic principles come through induction. And she was very, very uninterested in a deductive proof of something that she knew by direct relationship to reality. In regard to man, induction means the spectacle of man through the ages, abstracting thereby everything away except the essence. Now, if you try to do this one, reason is man's means of survival by deduction, it would mean an argument like this. And I've heard this 100 times. Objectivist graduate students just spew these things out. You know, just press a button and they come out. Life requires values. Values require action. Action requires knowledge. Knowledge requires reason. QED. Therefore, life requires reason. Reason is man's means of survival. Now, does that impress you? Because I can do that on anything now. Partly because I was once a rationalist myself, and partly because I'm hip deep in rationalists. You know, who can do that? That's their idea of thinking. Now that I regard as an utterly empty linguistic parade of words. How do you know life requires values? Well, they say, definition of life, self-sustaining. It has to pursue that which will sustain itself. Well, how do you know values require action? Well, value is that which one acts to gain and or keep. Where did your definitions come from, Ayn Rand? So it's just they take some definitions and string them together. That is not how you know that reason is man's means of survival. Reason is man's means of survival should be a condensation of a host of facts from every era, not an independent conclusion from premises. You have to observe. Now here I'm in a difficult situation because I don't have the time to chew all the kind of concretes, but we spent hours one night just trying to say what sort of observations you would need to come to the conclusion that reason is man's means of survival. And you'd have to observe throughout different eras and periods that man needs certain things for survival. And we're talking survival here. We're not talking self-esteem or higher literary self-expression. Food, clothing, shelter. And we'd have to trace all their historical variations and the ups and downs and show that from the very beginning, from the bearskins on up, a special kind of action was required to obtain it. Something we call production that animals have no counterpart of, an increasingly skilled production. Hunting, which requires weapons. Agriculture, which requires tools. The various improvements in these instruments. The development of trade, the division of labor, the Industrial Revolution, the thinking behind it. All of that as applied to food, clothing, shelter, over and over and over, a certain kind of action, a certain kind of productive action, requiring more knowledge, more thought, from the very earliest days when we wore bearskins or invented Stone Age axe or tried to figure out how to tighten this bearskin so it wouldn't fall off in the rain, all the way on to the computers and whatever we have now. It is action guided by conceptual knowledge, the kind of knowledge that animals or the retarded or the primitives don't have or don't have developed. In other words, reason was the faculty operating throughout. And of course, it's not just on food, clothing, and shelter, but it's important that you start there. You want to get your principles from reality, not from highfalutin psychological, you know, requirements. Then you can go from food, clothing, and shelter one step more abstract and say, well, we couldn't have survived without tools, weapons, and medicines, which are also physical requirements, and go back and show how tools developed. Without tools, there'd be no food. Without weapons, we wouldn't be able to support ourselves. Without medicines, we'd be like they are today in the rest of the world in the underdeveloped places. And again, we would trace the chain of discovery, why action is required, why achievement in these fields requires a special kind of knowledge, the kind animals can't get, the abstract kind, reason. Now, after enough of this, if you have a brain in your head, you get the point that reason is your basic means of survival. And you gained it through studying men across time, observing how they actually gain and continuously improve the things that enable them to survive. Now, I want to raise another question. So that does not follow from the definition of reason. or the definition of survival. I've heard people say, well, survival means survival as a rational being. So reason is man's means of survival is just really a statement that reason is needed to survive as a rational being, so it's an analytic state. Now, anybody that says that is out of philosophy, out of reality. That is another dimension. If you think that way, that is not thinking. That is not even intellectual chess. That is just a word salad. Now, I'm saying that as propaganda because some of you do that. The funny part here is that in a general sense, most philosophers would agree with what I've said so far. After all, you can't disagree with what I've said so far. I mean, even a PhD in philosophy does not prevent you from knowing that you need shoes and pies and houses and aspirin, that animals can't make them and we can, and it's because of our knowledge. Nobody could contest that. But none of these philosophers would dream of organizing an ethics around this discovery. Aristotle himself, the noblest man who ever lived, I mean, has character from everything we can tell. Brilliant ethical philosopher, also knew that it was our distinctively human faculty that made possible the tools, the weapons, etc. of survival. He did not dream of organizing an ethics around the principle that reason is man's means of survival. So that brings me to my final example of the role of history in philosophy. This is the point that always bothers objectivists, but perhaps now, in the fuller context, it won't bother you so badly. This is the point that the Industrial Revolution was essential to the formulation of the objectivist ethics. Ayn Rand said to me several times that she could not have grasped the full role of reason in man's life, nor thus her distinctive ethics before the Industrial Revolution. Even though the basic information of the role of reason was available to mankind all the way back to the Greeks, they had no way to emphasize, centralize, or exploit it. And it's very interesting here to go back to Aristotle and see how does he justify thinking. What does he think the validation or purpose of thinking is? And his answer, in essence, I'm simplifying, but his answer, in essence, and he is the best before the Industrial Revolution, was that there's two sides to reason, the practical and the theoretical. The practical guided our action and told us to, you know, follow the golden mean, live moderately, take into account the consequences of our behavior, and also guided the craftsmen in their lower task of, you know, making shoes and soap and digging roads, etc. The theoretical, which he thought of as a distinct faculty, was the part that studied logic, philosophy, science, biology, mathematics, and his justification for that had nothing to do with guiding action or creating physical instrumentalities or physical values. What was his justification? The opening sentence of his metaphysics. All men, by nature, desire to know. In other words, it happens to be a unique longing of man that he has curiosity. It's an end in itself. He has a need for food, and he has a need for abstractions, science, philosophy. And as one of the commentators on Aristotle said, he obviously wrote this before coming in contact with an American university. But as Aristotle saw it, the higher use, the theoretical use of the mind, that's everything involved in science, philosophy, and so on, was unrelated to survival, required leisure, required an aristocracy that did not have to grubby themselves with physical work, and that there was therefore two classes of men. There were the low artisan types who looked after the animals and the crops and so on, and they freed the people of higher intelligence to engage in thinking for its own sake. This seemed self-evident to the Greeks. This was one of the basic justifications of slavery, that the slaves had merely a passive intellect. They could understand what they were told to do, and they could go out, you know, and tend to the physical necessities, but they were basically bodies, whereas the thinkers were engaged in these high and important spiritual activities from which nothing practical would come. So you see, reality to them seemed to validate a mind-body dichotomy. There were the men of the spirit, and then there were the men of this world. And Aristotle never escaped the mind-body dualism of Plato, partly because he had 20 years of indoctrination from Plato, but partly because he himself thought this is life. It is true there's the spiritual side which has no practical significance, and there's the physical side which has very little intellectual content. Now I think you can get an idea why Ayn Rand needed the Industrial Revolution. If you tried to formulate objectivism without the Industrial Revolution, but with the best that you could do, the best will in the world, Aristotle's ethics is as good as you could get. It's the best you could get if you know Aristotle's ethics. It tells you, be worldly, no mysticism, no personal immortality, forget about prayer and God, etc. And yet, do not be a whim worshiper, don't be subjective, act according to principles. He couldn't exactly define the principles, but he tried. He said, be selfish, pursue your own happiness, select friends who fulfill your values, who are an alter ego, another I, another you in the other person. Pride is the supreme value. You have to have courage. You have to achieve moral perfection. You have to have a heroic stature. You have to use your intellect to the full. Pursue science, pursue philosophy. Why? To fulfill that aspect of your nature. So there was a tremendous amount in his ethics that you would agree with completely, and yet it's completely not oriented around the requirements of survival, and at key points all he can say is, well, this is what a good man does because this is what a good Greek does, and this is what we should learn because we have the capacity to learn it. Now, what the Industrial Revolution made perceivable for the first time is that thinking is practical. The most abstract thinking is practical. That, as Francis Bacon put it before the Industrial Revolution, but on the threshold of it as the modern world was getting started, knowledge is power, which was a thought utterly, utterly alien to the ancient world. They would have heard that exactly as you would hear today, chess is power. You know, not meaning, you know, that you're going to make a fortune and have a movie made about you, but just playing chess, what has it got to do with power? What has it got to do? It's just a game, that's it. Because that's what it was. It was a high-caliber chess game where you contemplate, fulfill yourself, relate ideas, and that's all. But what the Industrial Revolution is dramatized on a world scale, the connection between knowledge and life, between knowledge and survival. It showed that the more science, the more we develop those very, very abstract fields that only the curious were after, not the practical artisans, the more we develop those things that Aristotle called an end in themselves, The higher went our longevity, our standard of living, our health, and our wealth. And that therefore this was not something that we by nature wanted to know. It's something that by survival we have to know. And that science is the key to survival. When that was manifest, that was for the first time the key to destroying the mind-body opposition. Because now you could no longer divide the brute biological needs of survival from the higher spiritual science that has nothing to do with the crude needs of the body. The crucial thing of the Industrial Revolution, to repeat, is not simply that they produced wealth, but they produced wealth perceivably by basing it on the most abstract thought that man had ever performed, on calculus, on geometry, on mathematical physics, which until that time had been just curiosities. It had just been, you know, systems of ideas. And suddenly, those incredible abstractions that scholars were playing with transformed our whole view of life. Changed how long we expected to live and what ways we expected to live and under what conditions we expected to live. So that it became a matter, survival became a matter of appealing to the best and the highest in man. His ambition to know, rather than it appealed to just a low cunning that was okay for slaves or lesser intellect. That is what the Industrial Revolution made accessible to the world on a massive historical scale that was not perceivable before. And now Ayn Rand simply went one step further. You see, let's put it this way. Aristotle grasped the epistemological potency of reason, that it was valid. That it was our means of knowledge. Ayn Rand grasped the metaphysical potency of reason. That is the thing that enables man to achieve his values and above all his survival here on earth. And this, she is the was the first one to apply this new knowledge to philosophy itself. And therefore, in her view, for the first time, philosophy became a literally life and death practical matter, which it had never been. It was always, through the centuries, a system of ideas that people played with and argued against previous systems, but there was a kind of dichotomy between your theory and then your daily life. She is the first one to offer the idea that this is an urgent necessity. Philosophy, who needs it? Now, nobody would write a book like that because, in essence, they didn't think you needed it. They still held the classic view that philosophy is a satisfaction of your need to know the universe as a whole. The Greeks had no such idea as that pursuing philosophy would promote your survival. And this is why Ayn Rand took bad philosophies with such urgency. She didn't just dismiss skepticism or mysticism as, well, they're playing a different game, or they made a logical mistake, or they're nice guys, but, you know, I don't agree with them. She saw them that if broad abstractions are power, then the greatest power must pertain to the greatest, the broadest abstractions. And she applied that same thing, of course, to ethics. If abstract knowledge is a requirement of survival, then that must apply to a knowledge of ethics also. And thus the crucial idea of having a rational ethics as against the idea, well, survival is something that is a matter of instinct or natural resources or social conditioning or whatever. It's a luxury, it has no objective base. All of that grows out of the Industrial Revolution as a kind of cosmic demonstration of the role of abstraction in creating concrete values here on Earth during this life. So that leaves me with just one quick question, and then I'll give you your question period. This point bothers people. And it bothers them because they say, well, look, this means that Aristotle's time, or even in the 17th, 18th century, a person could have been completely rational, taken into account all the facts and all the knowledge, and not have known this crucial historical development. And the result would be, when the later development comes true, his thinking is superseded, and you just have to say to him, sorry, you lived at the wrong time, you missed the clue, you didn't get the picture, so your philosophy is outdated. Well, then we get the question, well, how do you know that in the 22nd century there will be some new vista of historical development which will enable us to understand philosophy in a way that we cannot now? You can't ask me to tell you what this new way is. All of our attempts, including objectivism in the 20th century, will be inherently inadequate or flawed because they will only go up to this point and they won't incorporate what is coming later. And therefore, if you want to be a skeptic, you draw the conclusion you can't really know anything until the last man dies. At which point we'll be invaded by spaceships and there'll be a whole new development, so it's hopeless. Now, does anybody want to answer that? I'm essentially completed what I want to say today. So if anybody wants to try to answer that, come up to the mic, please.
Well, basically, according to the spiral theory of knowledge, what would happen is we'd get more information, which would tell us more about what we already knew. Nothing would overturn anything we already knew.
You would have to assume that we are saying everything in the context of what we know, just as Aristotle was saying it in the context he knew. And all of the essentials of what Aristotle said remain valid. It's simply that he could not make certain connections which would have made aspects of his view clearer. But it didn't retroactively invalidate his viewpoint. It just left him with all he could get at that time. And I think any future discovery would have to be that. It will make more precise things that we're taking in a very generalized way. And it might cast a really sharp light on it. And they may very well say, God, Ayn Rand was really smart because not even knowing this, she said such and such, which now we can really explain. See, unfortunately, this is all floating abstractions because I can't. So I don't myself fear such a development unless you put it in an obviously refutable way. If you put it in terms of, isn't it possible that someday someone will discover a mistake that invalidates all of objectivism? Then I say that's arbitrary. You've got to come up right now with some evidence that that's possible. But if you don't go into the skeptic trap, I think all you can say is, I wish I could live to see it, and I would bet you any money that when it was finally discovered in the 22nd century, you would see that Ayn Rand anticipated, just as, this is true. If you read Aristotle, and some of you can confirm this, some of his weirdest books, like Parts of Animals, you can see in there, I ask Aristotelian scholars to bear this out, anticipations of Ayn Rand's view that a concept involves measurement omission. You can actually see that view, but he doesn't know what to do with it. He didn't make it central, and nobody would ever come up with that theory from reading him. But after you know it, you can see it in him. And I think when a mind is basically in touch with reality, that kind of thing happens time and time again. So that is my conclusion. Don't be disheartened, but also don't treat philosophy as a closed system. The principles are absolute, but the context can keep expanding forever. Yes, sir, you have a question.
Related to that, an answer to that, it seems that it has to do with the fact that all concepts are open-ended, and philosophy being a concept will always be open-ended, and what is there before isn't contradicted by what comes after.
Say that last sentence again.
I say what came before is not contradicted by what comes after.
Yes, a proper development of knowledge, your future knowledge, should not contradict your preceding. The most it should do, it would be like you discover another set of conditions that cause you to rearrange what you already knew. But if it invalidated everything we knew, you could never get to the 22nd century. So you can't use the ladder and then throw it away. If you got to use the ladder to get there, the ladder has to remain valid. Otherwise, you destroy the new discovery. Yes?
Something you said in your lecture kind of triggered this question.
A little louder, please.
I had the thought, given something you said in the lecture, that and I wanted to ask you, would you say that the most defensible or practical use of deductive logic would be to serve as a means to essentialize and reprise and the conclusions of an inductively arrived at argument or set of conclusions, and that rather than being a tool of rationalism, it can practically serve as a means to keep the conclusions in mind and essentials, so that you can, that if you've properly integrated it, it allows you to serve as a way to get access to the chewing that you've already done. Is that?
I have some difficulty hearing you, but if I understand you correctly, I would agree. Deduction is not the primary method of gaining knowledge from reality. Deduction is a way of applying to individual cases what you've learned broadly from reality. It's a way of applying a generality to a particular case, and it does have a great virtue in enabling you to systematize and structure the information you've already acquired. If you only had induction and all you could do is build up a whole bunch of generalizations, but you couldn't establish logical connections between them, that one was subsumed under the other, one was more particular than the other, one was in that sense deducible from the other, you would have no structure, you would have no hierarchy, you wouldn't know basically what was the order or organization of your knowledge. So deduction, I do not mean to derogate or sneer at in any way. Also, all of the more formal subjects, like mathematics and logic, work strictly by abstracting away from reality to simply certain starting points, and then use deduction to develop those tools. But then I hold that mathematics is simply a tool to aid in induction. It's not a world in itself that Bertrand Russell can become famous in. So I don't want to say that there's not a lot of valid uses of deduction, but I'm stressing that in philosophy, we have to have as inductive approach as in physics, which also uses deduction to apply and to systematize, and uses math, which involves deduction. But the primary way that physicists get contact with reality is observation. And then they can formulate hypotheses and deduce, the hypothetical deductive method. There's lots of places for deduction. What I'm against is the people who think deduction is the only tool a philosopher needs. You just start with something that seems self-evident, and then you just churn out the consequences. And the arch examples of that, really, in philosophy are the continental rationalists, like Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. Spinoza, who was a great philosopher, much better than Descartes or Leibniz in content, but he had ethics demonstrated geometrically. And he had axioms, And then he deduced, you know, all the different propositions and the corollaries, and it was a completely like a book on geometry. That is the exact opposite of the correct method.
My question is relating to lectures you gave some time ago on tape, elucidating objectivism, and in that you talked a lot about the rationalist way of thinking and the empiricist way of thinking, and you related the fact that you've discovered that most men will tend towards rationalism, where often women will tend towards empiricism.
Yes.
So thinking of that, I was wondering if you could just speak for a few minutes on the empiricist error, using the example of ethics that you used to talk about the rationalist error. Errors in thought.
What would an empiricist do in regard to ethics?
Well, in trying to validate ethics, you went through a very interesting
Empiricists and ethics always tend to be on the subjectivist side, because their classic argument was stated by David Hume. You can only go by what you observe. Essentially, there's no conceptual faculty, and what you observe is simply what is. So how can you ever come to the conclusion of what ought to be? That was what's called the problem of the is and the ought. No matter how much you put down, this is, how are you ever going to get to this ought to be? And therefore, and this is not just, you know, real far out ones like Hume or Ludwig von Mises, is exactly this in ethics. The ancient sophists were this in ethics, that there is no way to have an objective ethics. So in the same way that rationalists tend to be intrinsicists, they have absolute dogmas which they get either from God or Ayn Rand or whatever, and then they go around denouncing. Empiricists tend to be subjectivists and say it all depends upon what you want, or it all depends upon what society wants. We have a certain desire, and ethics is what leads to it, what fulfills it. Pragmatism would be another example of that. That would be the general manifestation in ethics. Hedonists would be an example of that. They tend to be whim worshippers, followers of emotion, in a way in which the rationalists would tend to be much more the religious or Kantian or Platonic type. You know, we have certain rigid principles. This was laid down, and you cannot violate it.
So if I can make sure I can get the bottom line on that, if someone who tends towards empirical thinking were trying to validate their ethics, it would really wind up just being emotional.
I mean, if they followed a strictly empirical method,
right,
it would wind up saying, I want so-and-so.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, that is where the best philosophers have ended up. Even Aristotle, in that way, his ethics ends up being subjective, because if you say to him, why should you pursue eudaimonia or happiness, what fulfillment? He just says, that's what man wants. This is the way people are. That's what they want. And then the question is, but should they want this? How do you validate the ultimate value? That's something that neither side was able to do, which again was one of Ayn Rand's big achievements, to show how inherent in the very concept of value was what the standard of value has to be, which introduced objectivity into ethics that it didn't have before. Before, it had the intrinsic or the subjective, and the better people were subjective, but the more principled people were, it's exactly, if you look at the Republican Party today as the history of philosophy, there's the religious right, which are principled in some sense, that if they're going to end abortion, no matter what, and they won't give an inch, and they're outraged at any attempt to, you know, to inject an exception. And on the other side is the moderates, who are more reasonable, but they don't hold as an absolute you have a right to abortion. They hold that you know, everybody has to be free to follow his conscience wherever it leads, and we shouldn't force you and you shouldn't force us. And it's basically, it's subjective. And you go and tell me which side is superior. You know, if you were Dole is trying desperately to find a via media between these two, mm-hmm. and his solution was to say, let's have a militant anti-abortion plank with an addendum saying we tolerate anything.
Right.
So, I mean, he just simply horrified both sides completely, which is the typical way of doing it. But that's what I would say about it.
That's good. Thank you.
Okay. Ed, is that
yes.
you?
Yes. Yeah. Ayn Rand said that axioms are implicit and self-evident in your very first perceptions, which would include, therefore, by implication, causality, which is the corollary of identity. On the other hand, you have mentioned that it took centuries to fully grasp that. Now, is the principle here that to go from the implicit to the explicit takes a great deal of additional inductive observation other than your first perceptions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To go from the implicit to the explicit is a tremendous feat, especially if you're talking about fundamental and broad principles like identity or causality. These things are implicit even in savages. And how many civilizations had to go by, I mean the Egyptian and the Babylonian and so on, before it ever became explicit? And how long to even get causality explicit? So it's not a paradox. Your mind gives you a certain start, which is what's available directly opening your eyes. But all that's available is the unconceptualized material and then certain categories that would be there if you learned to specialize your focus. But to learn to specialize, you have to cram yourself full of all kinds of perceptual data, which that implicit grasp makes possible, but you don't have enough yet to stand back and say, you know, if you think how you teach an ordinary class, A is A. You don't walk in and say, A is A. I tried that to a class once. And that one kid put up his hand and he said, yes, it's true, A is A, but A plus is A plus two. And then I realized that A didn't stand, you know, stood for a grade to him and not... So I had to change my whole method and make it inductive. And I'd come in and I'd say, this is a peach. What is this? He'd say, a peach. I says, is it also not a peach? No, a peach is a peach. And you do that on about 12 examples and then start to get, now if we used a letter to stand for anything, well, that's already, it's very difficult. Because what do you mean stand for anything? Well, it could stand for a peach and a candy. It's a very loose letter then. I mean, you have to get them through that. Finally, at the end of an hour, and this is, you know, in 20th century Brooklyn, you get some of the better ones to get an idea. A is A, you know. But even at this stage of the game, it's a lot of work to introduce that to a class. But for mankind as a whole, to be able to go through that is an incredible feat.
I have another one, but I don't want to hog all the time.
Well, I think we've got about 1 minute and we're already late, okay, so why don't you...
Go ahead,
Ben.
Could you expand on what you said yesterday about what it means to grasp an item of knowledge fully?
I can't hear you.
To grasp an item of knowledge fully.
Yeah.
For instance, if we take a simpler item of knowledge, say the leaves on that tree are green...
I simply can't make out your words.
Okay.
If we take a simpler item of knowledge such as?
The leaves on that tree are green.
The leaves on that tree are green, yeah.
It's close to the perceptual level, but yet it does relate to a lot of scientific knowledge.
Right. Well, there's two ways to look. I'll have to do it briefly because we only have a minute. There's two ways to look at that. If you're talking about a direct sensory piece of information, obviously you get that directly from reality. So it doesn't come as the culmination of a vast amount of information. So it would not be a direct parallel. I'm talking really on the conceptual level. And on the conceptual level, if you unpack what is required even to get that and then start integrating it, everything that you know about green or about light waves and everything that was required to get to light waves and everything about green about leaves and about botany and about cellular structures, etc. In other words, if you go beyond the bare datum, which is the mute pointing, which amounts to something, and you start identifying it, each concept arose in a huge context that has ramifications and subclassifications all the way through. Now, you would have your work cut out with a simple observation like that, but I believe that ultimately, if you worked it out, it would be integrated into the total fabric of biology, physics, etc., identity, causality, the whole works would apply to it. And there, I'll conclude here with a, there was a wonderful poem by Tennyson, which I was meant to bring, and I forgot. How many know that poem by Tennyson? Ivy in the crannied nook, or something like that. And it was, he's talking to this, and he says, little flower, that's what, because this would be perfect if I had memorized it, but he says, little flower, if I but knew what you are, I would know what God and man was. It's more, you know, poetic and beautiful and so on. But the idea is, if you knew everything about that leaf, you'd have to know what it's made of. You'd have to know its atomic structure and its subatomic structure and how it related to little stuff and how it related to the human beings and their values in planting it and the radiation that passes through it. And, you know, it was it wafting when Napoleon came by and the Battle of Waterloo and the whole bit? It's interconnected with the whole totality, you see. So if you go beyond just the brute, bare sense datum, it's an endless material for integration. But that doesn't mean that I can do more than just indicate some paths right at this point. Okay? Now, this is again 5 minutes late, but thank you for staying, and I'll see you again on Monday.